From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the former publisher of The Washington Post, Katherine Graham. She took on the Nixon administration during Watergate, defied a federal judge by publishing the Pentagon Papers, and built the Post into one of the great newspapers. She became known as the Iron Lady, but she was insecure and inexperienced when she inherited the paper from her husband after his suicide in 1963. The Post had been a family-owned paper purchased by her father when she was in high school. We'll talk with her about her new memoir. Also, rock historian Ed Ward on reissued sessions on the old Apollo label. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. At a time when newspaper women were pretty much confined to the women's pages, Katherine Graham became the publisher of the Washington Post, and she led the paper through its transformation into a major force in the political life of Washington and the nation. She gave the go-ahead on the publication of the Pentagon Papers and had reporters keep on the Watergate story in spite of White House pressure to get off it. Before she retired in 1993, she was sometimes called the Iron Lady, but her new memoir, Personal History, reveals the insecurities beneath the surface. The Post was a family-owned paper. Graham unexpectedly inherited the position of publisher when her husband, Philip Graham, committed suicide in 1963. He had taken the paper over from Katherine Graham's father when he retired. Her father made his fortune on Wall Street. He purchased the Post in 1933 when Katherine Graham was in high school. I asked what her reaction was.
I was very excited. I'd had a previous interest in journalism. I had even gone on the school paper before he bought the Post. And it whetted my interest, obviously. And I was excited. Of course, it wasn't like it is today. It was one of five newspapers. It was fifth in a field of five, and it had a circulation of 50,000. And it was in a really run-down old building on Pennsylvania Avenue. And so although it was thrilling, it wasn't like it would be today.
In 1940, you got married to Philip Graham, who you describe in your memoirs having a beautiful mix of intellectual, physical, and social charm, and that he was warm and funny on top of that. When your husband was 30, your father made him the associate publisher of the Post, and your husband virtually became your father's deputy. How did you feel about your husband going into journalism and going into the family business?
I was thrilled and loved it. I loved Washington. I loved the paper. We had discussed when he went in the Army, my father said, "Are you interested?" Because he was having a terrible struggle making the paper pay, making it viable. And he said, "I don't want to go through this unless there's some future for the paper. Are you interested?" And my brother was a psychiatrist and nobody thought of women's ever managing anything. And I said, "It's up to you. I don't want to try to influence you because it's you who are going to have to do it and it's your life." He had planned to go into law and politics in Florida where he came from. And so he thought about it a long time, and we talked about it a long time. And finally he agreed that after the war was over, he would come write on the paper. And that's what he did. I loved it.
Now, in 1948, when you were 31, your father decided to pass the paper on to you and your husband. But he gave your husband, I think, nearly three times more shares than he gave you. How did you feel about that inequity? After all, you were the direct descendant of the Washington Post family.
I had no reservations about it. My father said, "I'm doing this because I think no man should work for his wife." Obviously a sexist view of things, but not unusual in those days. And I had no problem with it. I thought it was okay.
Now, you describe your husband as using the Washington Post to right wrongs that you now think is inappropriate for journalism. Give us an example of how he used the paper to change things as opposed to just reporting on what happened.
The first thing he tried to change was the city itself. He redeveloped he was very instrumental in the redevelopment of Southwest Washington, and he certainly had it covered by reporters more than normally would have been. More importantly and more negatively for the paper, he got involved with future president, then majority leader Lyndon Johnson, and he was enamored with Johnson, and he really used the paper to support Johnson. Most importantly, for instance, during the civil rights battle, we were for home rule and civil rights and all that sort of thing. He influenced the coverage of a riot that occurred about opening a swimming pool. And Ben Bradley had covered it, and he was indignant. And my husband said, "Buster, come on up and come to my office. I want you to see what's going on." And in his office, he had Oscar Chapman, then Secretary of the Interior, and he had Clark Clifford, who was then in the White House. And he had a lot of people. And he made a deal with them. If the Post downplayed that story, they would open the swimming pools next year. Now, that was a positive act, but it was involving the paper in an active way that really shouldn't be done. I mean, you should report what is going on instead of using it to deal with the government.
What was at issue here, I think, was that the swimming pool was segregated and your husband wanted it to be integrated.
Of course, right.
And
which was a worthwhile goal, mm-hmm. but which he really committed the error of downplaying the news in order to make the deal about their opening the swimming pool next for the following summer.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Catherine Graham, who was the longtime publisher of The Washington Post. Her new memoir is called Personal History. You write that as your husband got more power in Washington, he also developed a drinking problem and the symptoms of manic depression. As for yourself, you write, "Despite my pleasure in the life I was leading during those years, I can see now that I was having problems I didn't acknowledge to myself. I was growing shyer and less confident as I got older. I still didn't know how to look my best or how to handle myself in social situations. I was afraid of being boring and went on believing that people related to us entirely because of my husband. As for him, at the same time that he was building me up, he was tearing me down. As he emerged on the journalistic and political scenes, I increasingly saw my role as the tail to his kite. And the more I felt overshadowed, the more it became a reality." When did you realize this, the sense that you were becoming more insecure and more overshadowed by your husband?
I only realized that in retrospect. Two or three close friends, when I went to them at the time that he left the house and went off with a young woman from Newsweek, said to me, "Good." And I said, "Good? How can you say that? It's just devastating. It's awful." And they said, "Don't you realize what he's doing to you, that you're the butt of the family jokes?" And I said, "No, I don't think that's right, and I really am distraught." So it shook me up that they viewed it that way, but I realized really many years afterwards that probably that was right.
What was happening in your life that made you feel increasingly insecure and insubordinate?
I was intimidated by him to the point where I didn't talk when we went out. I just let him talk. And sometimes if I did talk, or he would look at me as if I were going on too long. And it was that kind of thing that really made me think, gee, I must be boring. And I guess led to my silence.
You write that as your husband's behavior grew more erratic with his manic depression and he had an affair, he left you and then decided to buy back your stock within the Washington Post and take over the paper with his new lover. And in spite of your lack of confidence, you decided you were going to fight to hold on to the paper. How did you decide, given your insecurity at that time, to fight to hold on to it?
Because I first didn't, you know, I knew he was ill, and when he left, I thought, oh, well, he's ill. And finally, I realized that this was real, and he was going to lawyers, and he wanted a divorce, and that he was going to take the paper with him. And I thought, well, I can't help what he's doing, but I can fight for to keep the paper, and I'm going to. I mean, if he wanted a divorce, I was going to go into court. And the reason I think I thought I could do this was I knew that the paper had been built up with my father. I knew my father had supported Phil. I knew that I had, in my own way, supported Phil. And I thought he was great and that he had added greatly to the paper. But I had participated in the build-up through my father's earliest years and struggles, and year after year, discouragement because they kept losing money. And all that made me emotional about the paper. I loved the paper, and I just wasn't going to give up. I didn't think particularly how I would do it. I just was going to dig in.
What did your family think? Did they think that you should hold on to the paper because, after all, you were the blood member of the family? Or did they feel that, well, you were the woman, and even if you were divorcing, it would be better off in the man's hands?
No. Nobody thought that. My father had already died when this happened, but my mother was alive and supported me absolutely and said, you know, we've got to hold on to the paper. And so did all my friends and associates.
Then your husband came back to you, but one day after saying he was going to lie down, he went to the bedroom and shot himself. You heard the gun go off and found him dead. Did you ever think he would go that far, that his manic depression had gotten that severe?
No, and he was very deceptive. He told us all that he was feeling better, and he seemed to be feeling better. He'd been in a mental hospital and had gotten the day off. And I was deceived, and the hospital was deceived into thinking he was better than he was. And as I hear is mostly the case, he had talked a lot about suicide when he was ill, but never done it. And he wasn't talking about suicide at the time that he clearly had it on his mind. I think that happens.
Did he talk about suicide with you or just with other people?
He did with me earlier in the years when he was depressed.
My guest is Catherine Graham, the former publisher of The Washington Post. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Catherine Graham, the former publisher of The Washington Post. She's written a new memoir. After your husband's suicide, you were, as you write, pushed into a new and unknown life. What did you initially think you were going to do?
I thought I was going to work because I now owned the controlling shares of the company in the paper. And I thought I therefore had the responsibility to learn what made it happen and what made it tick, and that I would go to work solely to learn. That's the way I viewed it.
As opposed to actually take control.
Yes, I thought that there was a man who was chairman of the board, Fritz Beebe, and my husband had brought him on just about a year or two before he died, and he was wonderful, and he wanted me to go to work. And there were a lot of men running the divisions and the editors. And I thought, fine, this will just go on the way it is, and I can learn.
One of your colleagues, a man, said to you, "You're not going to work, are you? You mustn't. You're young and attractive, and you'll get remarried." Did you think, well, maybe that's what I should be doing? I should, you know, just get remarried, start a new family life at home.
No, that was said by a friend, not a colleague, Chip Boland, who was in the Foreign Service then and was a distinguished diplomat. And I saw him abroad just before I came home and went to work, and that's what he said. And I said, of course I'm going to work. And it didn't occur to me, in fact, that there was any conflict with getting married if I wanted to. I didn't really think. But in fact, it was so totally demanding that I probably couldn't have gotten remarried, but I didn't think about it.
You write that early on, after taking over the post, you were encumbered by a deep feeling of uncertainty and inferiority and a need to please and to be liked. You say, I was unable to make a decision that might displease those around me. How did that affect your decision-making early on and your interactions with the staff?
Oh, it got in my way a lot, but it's it tends to be female baggage, and it still is to some extent. But it was much worse then. The way it affected my performance is that I couldn't say, I've listened to everybody, and now I think we ought to do this. I had to get everybody to agree to whatever it was. And if everybody didn't agree, I'd go around begging them to see my point of view. And it was just a very poor way to be a leader.
Suddenly, your social circle expanded, but that circle was really pretty similar to the one you'd had before with your husband. But now, instead of being the wife, you were the publisher in that circle. How did that change your behavior in that circle, and was there an uncomfortable transition?
I think it was very gradual, because I was used to the people I was relating to, but my profile obviously grew with experience and with time in the job, and I suppose it rose considerably for a bizarre reason, which is that Truman Capote in 1966 gave the black and white ball in my honor. And so suddenly this was written about, and it was a big event, and it was covered. And it was really the beginning of my knowing those people who were at the ball. I didn't know them before that, and they certainly didn't know me.
What was the difference between how you acted within this larger social circle when you were seeing yourself as like the wife of the publisher of the Post compared to how you handled yourself when you became the publisher yourself?
It's hard to really think back to that. I just gradually grew used to it, and I realized that I was going to be conspicuous because I had the job I had. At one point, I was at my friend Joe Alsop's for dinner, and I had been used to the women and the men parting company after Washington dinners. While the men talked about issues and the women went and powdered their nose and discussed their households. And at one point, I suddenly realized that I'd been working all day, that I'd been involved in an editorial lunch with somebody who was in the news, and that I'd been working, and that now I was being asked to go in the other room with the wives. And I said to Joe, who was a good friend, I hope you won't mind if I slip out of here because the paper comes, and I really can use the time better than going in that room with the wives. And he said, oh, darling, you can't do that. And I said, sure I can. I mean, it's just, I don't want to use my time like that, Joe. And so he was so upset that he made me stay, and he broke up the segregation. And then it broke up all over Washington. So that was an instance where I guess suddenly I realized that I was in the working world and that I didn't have to do those things.
When you took over the Post, there were few women in journalism and far fewer women in the kind of upper position that you held. You said that early on you didn't realize that part of what you were experiencing was emblematic of the larger issues in the women's movement. What made you realize that your life really connected to the issues of the women's movement?
Two things. One is simply experience in the workplace and being talked to by women and issues coming up, such as really little issues, but they were symbolic. There's a big newspaper dinner, and no women had ever been invited, called the Gridiron in Washington. And I was invited as a guest. And the women rose up in the paper and wrote me and said, please don't go until there's a woman member. And at first I was startled and said, you know, I was rather thrilled to go, and after all, it was a gesture toward opening up. And they said, no, you know, until as a member, don't please go. And we feel very strongly about this. And so I didn't. And, of course, it made me aware of those issues. But the other thing that was as important, if not more so, was the rise of the women's movement. In particular, I became a friend of Gloria Steinem, and she argued with me about women's positions and how I should understand them. And at first I said, oh, Gloria, you know, that's not for me. And she said, yes, it is. If you understand what this is about, it will make your life better, and it will make other people's lives better around you. And she was right. So those two things, experience and Gloria.
Okay, so when you realized that Steinem was right and you more personally and intellectually connected to the women's movement, how did that change you personally and change the way you managed the Post?
I think it made you certainly more aware of women's problems in the workplace and of the need to get more women in the workplace. It made me more aware of bias in the news, such as somebody being described as a 58-year-old gray-haired grandmother. And I realized that I had to do something and try to make things better in the company. I didn't always succeed because I didn't quite know how to go about it in some cases. I didn't know how to lean on people who were doing a wonderful job but who were blatant male chauvinists and make them understand the issues. But little by little, we made progress, and some of it was due to being sued.
The Post was sued.
Newsweek was sued, the stations were sued,
mm-hmm.
and the Post.
Catherine Graham is the former publisher of the Washington Post. Her new memoir is called Personal History. She'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation with Catherine Graham, former publisher of the Washington Post, and we discuss one of the defining moments in the paper's history, publishing the Pentagon Papers. Also, rock historian Ed Ward on some jazz and rhythm and blues rediscoveries. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Catherine Graham. She was the publisher of The Washington Post from 1963 to 93. Her father bought the paper when she was in high school. When he retired, her husband became the publisher. After living in her husband's shadow, she felt unprepared to take over the paper after his suicide in 1963. On top of that, she had to assert her authority at a time when few women were in positions of authority. Yet it took a while for her to connect to the larger issues of the women's movement and to realize that women at the Post weren't getting a fair shake. Did you ever confront a man about his chauvinism on the job?
Yes. I wrote a note once that I found in the files in which somebody, a personnel director, had circulated a memo. And he had referred to the men as Brown, Smith, and Jones. And it was the women were Mary, Sue, and Margaret. And I said, wait a minute here. Why are we referred to by our first name and the other guys are last names? Another instance in which the issue arose was that I recommended a woman to be back of the book editor at Newsweek, and the editors just said, that's impossible, we can't do that. And I must say, I mean, we work long hours, we work weekends, we're here at night, and I stupidly accepted this. And then finally, we were sued by the women at Newsweek, and the editor and Frederick Beebe called me up, and I was on vacation, and said, the women are suing us, and this is very serious. And I said, whose side am I supposed to be on? And Fritz Beebe, my colleague, whom I really loved and respected, said, this isn't funny. And I said, I know it isn't funny, and I'm serious. And on the other hand, as a manager, it bothered me, and I got offended by these suits, but they were right.
The suits were right.
The suits were right, and we did make a lot of progress everywhere as a result, and also as a result of people understanding.
You made Ben Bradley the managing editor of the Washington Post, a move probably no one would dispute was a smart move. He became a very close working partner of yours, and you had a long and I think very gratifying working relationship with him. How did you decide to make him managing editor?
Little by little, I realized from things that happened, like people applying to be editor, or my friend Scotty Reston of the New York Times said, don't you want to hand on a better paper to your children than you inherited? And on the job, I realized that there was discontent in the city room and that things were not going as well as they should have been. And all this dawned on me gradually. And so I began thinking about it. And by accident, Ben Bradley had been, he was then bureau chief of Newsweek in Washington, And he had been offered two or three jobs to go to New York and get on the ladder and be one of the principal editors at Newsweek. And he turned them down, I think, first of all, because between him and his wife, they had six children, and he liked Washington, and he didn't move. And I thought, well, I better go talk to Ben, because I didn't really know him very well, but I had heard great things about how he was running the Bureau and how he was attracting talent and how the Bureau was good. And so I asked him to lunch, and I took him to a club because I'd never asked a man to lunch. And I didn't want to pay the bill. It's really funny. And so we went to a club I belong to. And I said, what is it that you do want to do? I notice you've turned these jobs down in New York. And of course, Ben being Ben said, well, now that you ask me, I'd give my left one to be managing editor of the Post. And now that's a little bit vulgar, but Ben talks like that. And I was really brought up short because I didn't expect that. And the managing editor of the Post was an old-timer, had been very loyal, and was a personal friend. And so I said, that's not possible in the near future, maybe someday. And then Ben began pushing. And I'd run into him, and he'd say, now, when are we going to talk? And I'd say, Ben, let's cool it. And it's too quick. And Ben kept pushing. And finally, first of all, I sort of resented it and wondered why, since he didn't have the job, he had the nerve to be so pushy. And thinking it over, I thought, well, maybe that kind of energy and that kind of drive is what we need. And so I checked up on him with people like Walter Lippmann and the people at Newsweek and asked everybody what they thought. And they all thought that was a great idea. And so eventually I persuaded the editors to bring him over as an assistant editor. They at first said, oh, fine, he can come on as a reporter like everybody else. And I said, no, I think this is needed in management. And finally he came over. And that's began the process of his succeeding the editor.
One of the defining moments in your career in journalism and in the life of the Washington Post is when you and Ben Bradley decided to publish the Pentagon Papers, the secret history of the war in Vietnam. And Ben Bradley was saying, publish it and publish it quickly. But your lawyers were saying, wait, don't publish it so quickly. In fact, maybe you shouldn't publish it at all. So either take your time or don't do it, but don't rush into it. How did you make up your mind, being in between your lawyers and Bradley and knowing that this was going to be a really important decision?
It was I had to do it very quickly, in about a minute, because the editors and the head of the company, Fritz Beebe, were at Ben's house, and they were writing, trying to keep it secret. And the lawyers were there, and they were saying it was very dangerous, and indeed we shouldn't publish, because the Times had been enjoined already from publishing by the government, who had taken them to court. And we were in the process of going public. We had announced our plans and not sold the stock, so we were particularly liable to any kind of criminal prosecution from the government. So finally, they called me up because it got so late and the argument got so tense and said, you're going to have to decide this. And I said, well, why do we have to do it right away? The Times took 3 months. And the editors all got on the phone and the business people were on the other phone saying, wait a day. The editors were saying, we mustn't wait a day. Everybody knows we have these papers and we have to maintain the momentum that was stopped when the Times was enjoined. And it's very important. People have their eyes on us, and we have to publish. And so I listened to them, and finally, after talking to both sides, I asked my colleague Fritz Beebe what he would do when he was a lawyer, and he said, I guess I would not. And that made it hard but not impossible. He said it in such a way that I thought, he's leaving it up to me, and I can do this. And so I said, let's go, let's publish. And I hung up because I was so freaked out by having had to make that decision so fast.
Did you have to decide at that moment what your guiding principles were, whether your guiding principles had more to do with journalism or with just protecting the profits of the company?
You know, I made speeches at the time, and I made them for rather another reason, which is that my image on Wall Street was that when we went public, which was later in 1971, I was this kind of nutty woman who was taking these risks with the company. And I started talking about excellence and profitability go hand in hand. And I really did it to show Wall Street that I cared about profitability because they thought I didn't. But in fact, I think it's true. And I really believed it, that if you invested in the editorial product and built up the production and business side, that it would work. And to a large extent, it did and has.
You built up a lot of animosity from the White House toward the Washington Post through publishing the Pentagon Papers and then breaking the Watergate story. And you say in the book, bearing the full brunt of presidential wrath is always disturbing. Now, you have told us about how insecure you were, the kind of low self-esteem you had as a professional when you took over the Post. And here you are now being criticized by the White House. Did you feel personally able to deal with that kind of criticism?
It was pretty scary, and you had to deal with it. Some people have referred to that as courageous, and I didn't view it as courageous. I viewed it as we had no choice. I think courage is when you have a choice and you choose to be courageous. I thought we had no choice once we got in the Watergate reporting. In the Pentagon Papers, that's true. We did have a choice for about a minute. In Watergate, it was like wading into a river. By the time you realized how serious it was, which was several months into the story, we were into it up to our waists, and there was no way you could go back. You had to go forward. And so I simply had to live with it. I was very anxious. I lay about a foot above the bed, worrying at night. But I also didn't think we had any choice except to proceed and to back the editors and reporters in whom I believed.
Were you worried that one day you'd find out that you were being misled, that you were set up, you were the victim of some kind of scam?
Indeed, I was. I used to go down and talk to Ben and Howard Simons, the managing editor, all the time, and ask, are we being fair? Are we being accurate? And are we being set up or misled so that our heads can be chopped off? And they had good answers to these, and they were really reassuring. I don't think they were as assured themselves as inwardly as they seemed to be to me. But they said that some of our sources were Republican, and that because we had the story to ourselves, that Woodward and Bernstein had time to check, and that they often withdrew a story by themselves unless they were... And they had two sources for everything. And thirdly, that Woodward had a source, particular source, to whom he went when he was really bothered and puzzled, and that this source had never misled him. And, of course, the source was later christened by the managing editor, Howard Simons, Deep Throat. I still don't know who Deep Throat was. I didn't know then, and I don't know now.
Are you glad you don't know so other people can't try to get it out of you?
Well, I said to Woodward at one point we met over lunch, and I turned to him and said, who is Deep Throat? And he looked pale and flinched, and I said, oh, it's all right. I don't want the responsibility. You don't have to tell me. He says that he would have told me if I'd asked for it, but I didn't ask for it, and I still don't.
Someday maybe you will, though?
No, not now. Too late.
Too late.
Been there, done that.
My guest is Katharine Graham, the former publisher of The Washington Post. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Katharine Graham, the former publisher of The Washington Post. She's written a new memoir. You're turning 80 this year.
Yes.
And in your memoir, you write that turning 70 was actually very difficult.
It's true. I think certain birthdays bother you more than others. 50 didn't bother me much. 60 did. 70 did. 80 doesn't.
Why doesn't 80? 70 did, but 80 doesn't.
I think that at 70 I thought, oh, gee, I guess I'm an old woman. And I've come to terms with that. You know, when we're young, you never think you're going to be old. And you saw, in my day, you saw people with white hair and buns on their head and little old ladies. And I thought, I'm never going to be like that. I mean, I didn't even think about it. I just thought you were young forever. And so to realize that I'd turned 70, I really wanted not to broadcast it. And I went on a trip with some friends out to the West Coast to avoid any observation of it. But my daughter and my children said, well, we want to give a party. And I said, oh, all right, if it's a little party. And, you know, I don't want a lot of people. I don't want people to know I'm 70. And they got the bit in their teeth, and they gave a small party for 600 people, which was widely covered. So this was not a secret from the world.
And your thoughts on turning 80 now?
It's hard because you worry about getting not to be your best. I've been very lucky. I've been able to keep up tennis and keep up movement, and I've been very healthy. And I worry that you might decline or that you might not be able to keep up the life you've lived. But I'm very determined to try to keep going, keep interested, keep involved, and keep learning. I think all that's very important.
You retired from the Washington Post in 1993. What's your connection to the paper now?
It's peripheral, but interested. I have a title, chairman of the executive committee, which consists of my son and the chief operating officer, Alan Spoon, the president. And the three of us talk from time to time. I'm still on the board. I keep interested and involved in commenting, and they sometimes ask my advice, and sometimes I give it to them unsolicited. But I'm very interested and involved, but they run it.
Are you glad that your son, Donald, who is 51 now, is running the paper, that it's still in the family?
I'm thrilled, yes. I care a lot about that. And I think he's doing a great job, and so is his colleague, Alan Spoon. I think the everything is continuing to improve and grow, and that's what you want. And I think they're great.
There aren't that many family-owned newspapers left in the United States. What do you think is the legacy of the family-run paper?
It can be anything. I mean, if the family gets is involved in a good way, it can be very good and it can be very positive. Sometimes in the third generation, families get big and they start fighting, and then that's not good. Sometimes families don't, they can be either way. They can care or they can not care. They want, some of them might just want profits. I think when a family is involved in a good way, it's really wonderful and the best way, in a sense, to run newspapers and other things.
You've just completed your memoirs, and I'd like to know what surprises you most about your life and who you became.
Well, looking back on it was really interesting, and I liked it. I think this thing that surprised me the most was the role my father played in my growing up. He was very shy and reticent and not very articulate. So I didn't realize until I reread his letters and mine to him how loving and supportive and important he was to my life. I think that's the biggest discovery I made. And I really, really was moved by this.
Catherine Graham, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I thank you. I had a wonderful time, and I appreciate your letting me be here. Thank you very much.
Catherine Graham's new memoir is called Personal History. Coming up, some jazz and rhythm and blues rediscoveries. This is Fresh Air. Of all the independent labels that flourished in post-World War II America, none, according to rock historian Ed Ward, is as mysterious as Apollo. Ed says Apollo recorded some of the most important talent in New York and elsewhere during its heyday. However, much of its material has long been out of print, its whereabouts unknown. Now some of it has surfaced on a series of reissues on the Chicago Delmark label.
Records was founded in 1944, and like many labels in those days, it was initially based in a record shop run by a white couple named Berman. The Bermans had a distinct advantage over some labels, though, in that their shop was located near the Apollo Theater, Harlem's legendary talent showcase. With all the performers flocking to the theater, it wasn't hard to come up with artists for the new company.
We want Canada.
What do you mean, we want Canada? Don't let Mr. Schiffman hear you say that. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is your master of ceremonies, Willie Bryan, coming to you from the stage of the 125th Street Apollo Theater. It's your amateur night in Harlem. Well, here we go now. Look out. Now, if you think you can sing and dance, let me hip you in advance. Anyone here can take a chance at amateur night in Harlem. Why, maybe you can hit the top, who can tell? Then again, if you should flop, Puerto Rico's gun will pop. At amateur night in Harlem, don't you know every Wednesday night you can find a lot of new stars to follow when they make their debut on the stage of the old Apollo. Do you know, folks, that Ella Fitzgerald started here? You too can start a great career or get thrown out right on your ear. It's amateur night in Harlem. Look out, Tab Smith.
One of their releases, in fact, was this tune by Willie Bryant, who led the pit band at the Apollo and who is known as the Mayor of Harlem. They made history with their very first session. Featuring Coleman Hawkins, an established star, playing compositions like Budidot, written by the trumpeter on the session, Dizzy Gillespie, the six sides that resulted from the February 1944 date are considered the first bebop recordings. They didn't sell, but they are of immense historical importance. With radio play almost non-existent for R&B and jazz, all of these labels had to rely on jukeboxes for sales, and Apollo's approach to this was to release as many records as possible, getting their material from wherever they could. Somehow, they had a constant supply of music from the West Coast, some of which, like this session with Dinah Washington, with help from Charles Mingus and Milt Jackson, was superb.
I'm in love with a man who's not in love with me. Yes, I'm in love with a man who's not in love with me. If I can't get that man, I'd just as soon be down deep in the sea.
And the label's economic backbone was always commercial jazz by tenor saxophonists like Arnett Cobb, Bobby Smith, and Willis Gator Jackson. Unfortunately, the Delmark reissues are only of Apollo's 1000 series, the records designated by the Burmans as blues or jazz. I say unfortunately because the label's best-known star was neither.
Move on up a little higher, Lord. In my darling mouth. Move on up a little higher, Lord. Be
Mahalia Jackson's debut for Apollo, Move On Up a Little Higher, sold 2 million copies for the label, and several of her subsequent records did nearly as well. Mrs. Berman was a tough cookie by all reports, and she always had a clause in her contracts with gospel singers that allowed them to record secular material if they wanted to. Seeing the numbers, she pressured Jackson so hard to cross over that she eventually drove her into the more accepting arms of Columbia Records. She succeeded with another group, though, the Royal Sons. Their sales were nothing to get excited about, and they had come to New York City from North Carolina, so it was easy to get the dazzled country boys to change their name to the Five Royales and start making R&B. Changing times, the Paola scandals, and economic conditions put Apollo out of business in 1962, although they continued to repackage their Mahalia Jackson catalog. The folks at Delmark think the Burmans are probably dead and won't reveal where they got the masters they've reissued, so in death, as in life, Apollo Records remains as mysterious as ever.
Ed Ward is a music writer based in Berlin. Most of the music Ed played is from the Apollo series on Delmark Records of Chicago. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tenenbaum. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.